Hi, it's Karen Webster for Payments.com, and I'm here today with Johnny Ayers, who is the co-founder and Senior Vice President for Business Development for Socure. Johnny, thanks for joining me today.
Thanks for having me, Karen.
So we're here to talk about financial inclusion, but from a very different perspective, and let me set this up. At the Innovation Project not that long ago, I was chatting with Dan Schulman, the CEO of PayPal, who really is passionate about the concept and the notion of financial inclusion. He made a very interesting comment about the root cause of financial inclusion. He said, financial inclusion is really about financial health. And if I think about connecting the dots between what he said and what I know is very front and center for you, financial health is about knowing the identity and being able to validate the identity of that individual. And I know that is one of the things that you believe is a real impediment to financial inclusion. Why is that?
Absolutely. So the way that we look at an identity as it pertains to basic financial rights is that a traditional savings account or DDA account should really just be about, is Karen real? Is Karen an authentic person? It's not on any watch list, whose identity that we can verify. Because there's very little credit risk that's associated to basic traditional bank accounts. And so it should really be an identity decision that the bank makes to offer kind of standard traditional financial tools versus a credit decision, because there's very little credit risk that's actually at play.
Got it. So your fundamental premise is, if we can't validate that Karen is Karen or Johnny is Johnny, the whole system falls apart. How does that, though, vary country to country? Aren't there mechanisms in place today where banks go and say, I can identify that that's Karen who is Karen? Isn't that the way it's done today?
So traditionally, both in the U.S. and abroad, it's been based off of credit bureaus who have really been the driver behind identity verification and knowing your customer. Unfortunately, credit, as we know here in the U.S., only covers about 70 or 80% of the population. Domestically, it's maybe 15 countries, give or take, that actually have traditional developed credit systems. And generally, the rest of the world is on prepaid. There's 7 billion mobile devices. Only 1 billion of them are postpaid. And so you have a lot of countries around the world where there's just not sufficient offline data to be able to verify that a consumer is who they say they are and de-risk a digital transaction. Specifically in countries like the United Kingdom, you've seen new businesses like Monisi's or Adam or Loot that have popped up to solve particular problems, whether it be a millennial or an immigrant, where they've had to effectively write new KYC processes from scratch. And they've had to be very, very creative in the way that they do it and the types of data that they look at beyond just traditional data and beginning to look at email data, phone data, online social data to try and get to a yes, this is actually Karen and Karen is an actual real authentic person.
So when you talk about financial inclusion, then you really expand the scope to include those that we would characterize as not really having a very thick credit history or a thick file at the credit bureau, but someone who may not have that because they just haven't lived long enough to get credit. Perhaps they don't qualify to get credit, but we still need to know that it's Karen or Johnny. So how do you solve that problem reliably to de-risk the decision about validating the identity of a person that doesn't have a lot of data behind it?
Absolutely. It's a tough problem. You know, I think it's a problem that there's a number of companies are trying to solve, us being one of them. And it's to look at, you know, who and what your identity looks like across all mediums. So, for example, you know, I'm 30 years old. I've had my Gmail for more than 10 years. I've had Facebook and LinkedIn and a number of social media accounts since 2004, 2005. I've had a postpaid AT&T phone since I was 17 that's connected to my email, that's connected to my physical address. The data is available out there. It's just about developing real-time search engines, developing complex, you know, identity and entity resolution engines to be able to resolve the right Karen for this particular transaction so that we can say yes to those 20, 30, 40% of people, or in some countries, 100% of people that are outside of the traditional credit databases.
So are the big banks thinking along these lines as well, or is this too new and unproven for them to consider?
Absolutely. You know, two big banks that have publicly spoken about it. Attorney General Schneiderman here in New York was very outspoken in challenging Wall Street that, you know, a basic DDA account should be a God-given right. Every single person in the United States, specifically here in New York, there were 3 million people in the state of New York that did not have a basic bank account, that are being forced to keep cash in their closet because the banks can't and are not doing enough to say yes to them. And so he challenged them, and Capital One and Citi have actually been the first two banks to say, we are going to roll out new basic retail banking product offerings where we are going to use alternative data. We are going to use every piece of data we possibly can, not necessarily get to a no, but to use every piece of data they can to get to a yes, unless they believe the individual to be fraudulent. So there are a number of, you know, top five, top 10 banks that are very actively moving down this path as we speak.
That's interesting, because I think the very first point that you made is that doing this doesn't necessarily require a credit decision be made. It's really an access to a relationship that could lead at some point to a credit decision, but first and foremost, just a path to access with a bank and a DDA account that they can then begin to use to transact.
Absolutely. I mean, my co-founder, our CEO, when he first moved to the U.S. in the mid-90s, after having a robust credit report over in the U.K., when he moved to the U.S., he had to start from scratch. And his first card was actually a prepaid card, which he had to leverage to begin to develop credit effectively as if he were, you know, 21 years old again, opening his first credit account. And so, you know, we have, you know, very real at-home stories where, you know, people are very credit worthy in other countries and move here for a time and have to start from scratch.
So let's play hypothetical for a minute, and let's imagine that the 3 million people you identified in New York who don't have access to a DDA account could. And let's say tomorrow everyone had access to that. What's the impact on, in particular, security and fraud prevention? Giving access to people, being able to validate their identity, that seems to have a good outcome beyond just giving people access to a funding account.
So the way that we think about the problem is three sides of a triangle. One side is fraud, one side is acceptance, and then the third side is manual review. You can only optimize for two sides of the triangle at any given time. So if you accept everyone and you have no manual review, you're going to have a large amount of fraud. If you completely stop fraud, well, it's pretty easy to stop fraud. You just don't let anyone in the door.
Right.
And then if you want to optimize for manual review, to not have to manually review every single transaction, you're going to let in a little bit of fraud. And so you're kind of playing this kind of juggling act between the three sides. And so in order to, of course, increase acceptance, you have to bring in new fraud tools. You have to look at new types of data. You have to use new forms of machine learning. You have to move away from, unfortunately, a lot of the legacy systems that are bogging down a lot of these financial institutions now. You know, some of the credit bureau products, some of the legacy rules-based products, and you have to move to a machine that's leveraging the newest forms of prediction in order to bring down that fraud to an acceptable rate.
But it seems like, though, in a system that's set up to identify individuals and to validate their identity, you can begin to, through the three sides of the triangle, suss out the good actors from the bad actors in a more methodical way.
And I think as we've kind of progressed with each new identity breach, unfortunately, that problem between just using, you know, name, address, date of birth, SSN, becomes more and more and more difficult. So as we're trying to say yes to more people, the fraudsters are actually getting their hands on more real good people's data. And so it becomes harder and harder to actually differentiate between, you know, okay, I believe Karen's a real person, but now is this actually Karen that's presenting the identity?
Mm-hmm.
And so it's as we are opening the door, the fraudsters are getting more sophisticated, and thus the tools that we use to differentiate between not only saying yes to Karen, but actually predicting whether or not this is Karen, has to get more sophisticated and has to get more sophisticated very, very quickly.
So as we think about this new way of addressing financial inclusion and doing this on a global basis, what do you find yourself having to talk to people and convince them they need to be thinking differently about in order to solve the problem? What's missing?
Sure. So I think it's a little different between, you know, kind of the large traditional banks versus some of the new fintech players. I think the fintech players, as they're building tools, you know, that they started building in 2013, 2014, 2015, they were pretty aware of their problems from day one. For example, you know, a lot of the internet banks, a lot of the robo-advisors, a lot of kind of the consumer lending platforms, in leveraging the traditional credit bureaus, they found that, you know, they had a 40%, 50% reject rate in automating kind of their onboarding flow. So, you know, they kind of knew the problem from day one. And so for us, it was more positioning how we can leverage new types of data, new types of machine learning to better predict and effectively solve that problem of how do you reduce the number of false positives. As, you know, 98% of people are good, how do you get closer to that 98% of programmatically saying yes to new customers? So that's kind of one piece, is they know with millennials, they know with immigrants, they know they have a problem from day one. It's just kind of helping them understand in actual practice how you can leverage this new data to make better decisions.
So how do they do that? It's really a little chicken and egg, because they have to trust the model, but no one wants to be the first to trust the model.
Sure. So a lot of them in practice, you know, we've done head-to-head tests where they continue to run a traditional system and they run ours alongside of it for 3 months or 6 months till they get comfortable and get to a place where they can, you know, go ahead and cancel the legacy contract and move forward with the decisioning using a newer system.
Wow. Well, it's a fascinating topic and a very creative twist on thinking about financial inclusion and solving what is the access problem, and that's really about verified and validated identity. Johnny, thanks for giving us the benefit of your insight today. Fascinating conversation.
Absolutely, Karen. Thanks so much.